Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. With me is my co-host, Burl Love, and today's guest, turns out it's all things Bengals these days. Woohoo! Hoo day! We're going to the playoffs! And so we were like, let's get an expert on, and that happens to be former Cincinnati Bengal David Fulcher. And we are really looking forward to talking to him today. He was at the game on Monday night. We feel like he can really offer some perspective, but he's Cincinnati through and through, doing some good. And I just think that's going to be a great conversation today.
I think it's going to be a great conversation with Fulcher. He, like you said, he was at the Monday night game when DeMar Hamlin went down. And I believe we can talk to him about this. He was the torchbearer that night, which is all about getting the crowd hyped up as the Bengals run onto the field. But, you know,
he did a very good job. I'm not going to lie.
You know, he we'll get into this, I'm sure. But, you know, after his Bengals career, even though he wasn't from Cincinnati, he stayed in Cincinnati. He's been involved in a lot of philanthropic efforts. So we'll talk football. We'll talk philanthropy. We'll talk why they call him Faux Rock. That's a good story, too. But let's talk about a couple things that you've been following, Sherry, because we were waiting for some, you know, the other shoes to drop when it comes to a couple, the future of a couple of our political types in town. And so those other shoes dropped. We kind of know who's going where, sort of. But you want to start with our good friend, Joe Dieters?
I'm calling it political musical chairs. So there's going to be some big shakeups coming. And honestly, there were some big shakeups. You know, at the beginning of this year, we saw longtime Hamilton County prosecutor Joe Dieters be named to the Ohio Supreme Court. So that appointment frees up his job, meaning we're going to get a new prosecutor. And also we saw Alex Triantafilou, a very recent guest on this show. We talked about his bid to become the Ohio GOP chairman, and he got that job. And so this is very big for South. We'll talk about each of those positions, but this is very big for Southwest Ohio because it used to be a juggernaut in Columbus of, you know, really our politicians going up there, running the state. And for a little bit, it really hasn't been that. But, you know, the elevation of these two prominent Southwest Ohio Republican politicians, you know, kind of injects a little bit of Cincinnati into the state house. And we don't always get that.
That's true. Let's start with Joe Dieters, and we'll get the elephant out of the room taken care of right away. Some are calling this a blatant political appointment. Joe has not served on the bench. He has close ties with the DeWine family. His electability, if he were to run again for prosecutor, it gets tougher and tougher for Republicans to win in Hamilton County. Was this a, Joe, thanks for your hard work. We're going to let you safely ride out your career in politics on the highest court in the state?
You know, I'm 50-50 on what's going on here. And Scott Wortman, our political reporter, I do believe is kind of working on a bigger story about this right now. And so we'll wait for some of those facts to flow out. But on one hand, these are always political appointments. Mike DeWine is not going to point somebody to the Ohio Supreme Court. First of all, he's a Democrat. That's ridiculous. So it is going to be a Republican, and he's going to choose somebody who shares the same ideals as him and is going to do things he thinks are important for this state. And he has known Joe Dieters a long time. And so you're going to have trust in that person, and that's why you might pick that person. Now, normally you see somebody with a little bit more experience, you know,
being a little bit more experience and dare I say, dare I say what they might call judicial temperament.
You know, I do think I'm not worried about that. Of all the things that are going on here. Joe knows how to play a role. I'm sorry. Like, he did believe, I think, the things that he would say about, you know, that's a thug and all of these, you know, things. He was known for his rhetoric, certainly. But I think That was part of his role. It is who he is, but in that job, I think he understands what the temperament of an Ohio Supreme Court judge is, which is much more tempered. And I think he's ready for that at this point in his career. And so that's not something I'm worried about, but certainly that's how we know Joe.
Now, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, there's no, you know, congressional hearing. DeWine makes the appointment. He's sworn in. It's a done deal. We don't really have the opportunity to hear the legislative branch ask questions such as, you know, that would give you an idea of whether Dieters might be more of an activist judge on the court or more of a state constitutional purist. Do you think his politics, his, you know, he's been very vocal on, you know, a tough stance on crime and drug convictions. And, you know, he's known for that very pro, and again, appropriate for his role, pro law enforcement. Do you think he will set that aside and be more of a, you know, contemplative type judge? Or do you think Joe will carry some of that with him on the bench?
He'll carry some of that with him on the bench. You know, he was instrumental in imposing the death penalty for people who kill children. That was something that he was very passionate about. He didn't just do that as the prosecutor, but he did that because he really believed in that. And like, that's something he will carry forward to the bench. He has said that he believes in the death penalty for certain people. And like, I don't think that's going to change. And he's going to like feel differently about that kind of thing. Well, his rhetoric toned down, certainly, but his beliefs are his beliefs. He is set in those.
Well, I know it will be, I think it'll be good for us as a local news organization, because I think there'll be some interest in what the Supreme Court does, just to see, you know, how Joe handles the role. Is he
Supreme Court justices from here.
Right. And, you know, will he be someone who writes a lot of opinions? Will he, you know, will he kind of start his service on the Supreme Court more quiet and, you know, understated? I doubt, it's hard to say understated
definitely
in the same sentence.
But
it's going to be very interesting. And I think to your first point, we in Southern Ohio do love it when our folks are in, you know, high roles, high political roles in the state. And so what a great segue. We have Alex Chantafilou, who is now the chair of the state Republican Party, creating a vacancy in Hamilton County. He was campaigning hard for that, going around the state. It wasn't a slam dunk, but when the votes were counted, he had the job.
It wasn't a slam dunk, not because of who he is. It wasn't a slam dunk because, you know, the smaller counties in Ohio, which outnumber the larger ones by a lot, you know, they know the smaller, the candidates from those smaller counties, and they tend to kind of group together. So that just made it difficult for Alex coming from a big county. You kind of stay in your big county. You have to do the big county work, but these smaller jurisdictions, you know, they kind of get together and everything. That made it more a difficult path for Alex to get this job. And so I don't actually know what took him over the edge, but I do know, you know, he's a very prolific fundraiser and he understands what it takes to win these races, these big races, these big money races. And I think that's kind of what put him over the top in getting him there. It'll be interesting to see. Certainly is an easier job than Hamilton County, which is bluer and bluer and bluer. And so he had no easy task here for him. But he has to hold on to all of those seats and, you know, make sure that he has a lot to coordinate. Being a statewide party chair, David Pepper has said on his podcast before, it's hard. This is a big state.
Well, what do you think his appointment means for Cincinnati area Republicans? Does it matter at all?
You know, it does, just because they're very worried about this prosecutor seat, and that is obviously going to be up to the candidates themselves, but the party chair is going to have to be the wings beneath their wings. so to speak. It's going to have to be big money raising. It was this last time for Joe even to be reelected. He raised $1 million. I expect this race to be more high dollar this next time than that. And so that this person has to worry about that. And I really think they want to get some of these judgeship backs. They're just, I mean, they actually lost a judge who was a Republican who can win. Tom Heakin switched parties. Like the new party chair really has a lot to get in order here in Hamilton County. They're going to be looking for a candidate to go up against Greg Landsman. Yes, he just won, but 2-year terms are not that long. They're like practically nothing. And so they really are going to come into this job and there's no learning curve. And we did already see Tom Brinkman. I'm not surprised, kind of say, publicly say he's jumping into the fray. There's a couple names being tossed around.
Tell our listeners who Tom Brinkman is.
He's a state representative from Mount Lookout, and you might recognize his name from filing lawsuits against the city. He ran for council. And so he's kind of looking for his next thing right now. And, you know, I saw like party chair, but he's very conservative. And I'm not sure that that's what the party's looking for, but maybe. The vice chairman, Triffin Kallos, works at the prosecutor's office, but he, I believe, is a Green Township trustee. And he's like, I'm too busy, he said. But that doesn't always mean you don't take the job. The party really needs you to do it. I'm hearing former judge Russell Mock, his name being tossed around. I think. In the coming days, we're going to see like who's really in contention there as they work to select somebody.
Well, just walk us through quickly the what's next in both scenarios. So you have longtime assistant prosecutor Mark Pietmeyer is the interim prosecutor now in Hamilton County. What is the procedure for actually permanently replacing Dieters?
So the elected delegates in the Hamilton County Republican Party, they're going to vote on the 19th on who they want to be prosecutor. And that just has overwhelmingly, yes, it's a vote, but it is going to Melissa Powers, a former prosecutor, a former Hamilton County juvenile court judge, was her last job. And she will be the prosecutor. So I expect that kind of in 2 weeks. But honestly, even like kudos to the Hamilton County commissioners for appointing Mark, because that's the right decision. He has tons of experience and he's already like doing so much of the work to run the prosecutor's office. He was the number two basically. And they didn't play any political games. They didn't say, well, I put a Democrat in there until you sort this all out. Even as a 1-2 week, get somebody's name out there for this job. They just were like, here's seamless 2 weeks. Just do it. So kudos to them.
And hats off to you, Sherry, for that scoop last week on Powers. That was one of those times where, you know, people ask me sometimes, like, what is your job? Do you have to read every story that the Enquirer publishes? And that would be an impossible task. But one important job I have is when reporters like you are working their sources and get good information from people who don't necessarily want to go on the record, we have a decision point. Do we publish that? Do we hold off? But so we had that discussion about going with that story, and others followed suit. But nice work there, Sherry.
Thank you. You know, I will say a couple people before Christmas were like, you know, we're hearing Missy Powers and everything. I really did wait. I knew it was a vote. I don't think everybody understood the process. And at the point when her name was even first mentioned, I was like, we have to check with delegates. We have to check this and make sure we're 100%, because you never know. You know whose name I heard in contention, which he kind of shot down, but people, they're very worried about winning this seat. Very. Now, a woman running, and she has this stellar record. They are like, she's, you know, going to be good. And they're like, okay. But I heard Judge Ruhlman, he had to retire for age limitations for judges. And I heard his name tossed around. And so before I needed to really make sure it was going to be her, because you just never know.
Well, and then she finishes up the term. And then, as you kind of hinted at, they were looking for someone they think can win an election as well. So,
and raise the money and win the election.
Those are almost synonymous these days. raising the money and winning this election. It's hard to do one without the other. So, and then we have, as you said, Trifon Kallis, Alex's assistant, is now the interim chair of the Hamilton County Republicans. What does that process look like for deciding who follows Alex officially? It's a mystery.
That's kind of playing out still of like, I don't know who makes that decision. I should know, but, and I care, right? Like, this is a person I talk to all the time for my reporting. You know, the Republican Party chair does always keep an eye on that very Democratic city hall. And so, yeah, I really should know more about that.
Well, you can't know everything, Sherry. I mean, my guess is much like the statewide role is that the members of the county party will at some point have a vote, I'm sure. But if that's not right, we'll dig into that and bring everyone up to date. I'm sure someone will email us both now and call us out for not knowing that and set us straight. But
I suspect it might be Scott Wortman.
Yeah, I bet we should have had.
You made my story, Sherry. I can hear it now.
Well, like you said, musical chairs. Before we get to our special guest, David Fulcher, I also want to point out that on Sunday, we published what we hope to be our annual community impact report. We listed 10 stories that made a difference. We did last year. Now, of course, I hope people think there are more than 10, but 10 stories that brought some sort of action or shed some light on an issue that needed to be dealt with. You had a story on that list. The power outage at the water treatment plant that was not disclosed to the public, but was first reported by us, and that was your story. That type of watchdog journalism, we want to make sure we pause at the beginning or at the end of the year and kind of review the impact we made. So thank you for your contribution to that. Can you remind our listeners what was the circumstance with that water plant?
You know what? The Eastside water plant went down. And honestly, you know, the city ended up getting water from Claremont County. There's backup systems in place and it worked exactly as it should have. So on its surface a little bit, it was like, well, by the time I found out about it, right, it's done. It's nobody knew or anything. The city really argued very hard that I should not be writing this story for that very reason. But, you know, they didn't tell anybody. And this was kind of on the heels of what was happening in Jackson, Mississippi, with their water system, which has had even more problems since then in Jackson. And this, the water system is very important. And I had, you know, an expert tell me when I was doing my reporting, he's like, thank you for doing the story. He's like, because at the very least, it reminds people that they need to pay attention to what's going on with their water system. He was like, it's the least boring thing. It's the thing you need the most. And he's like, citizens have a right to know every single thing going on with their water system at all times. And so that was kind of the impact of that. It's like just telling people and putting that out there about this very important utility that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Well, I hope it sends the message, too, that if any of our elected leaders, any of our agency heads have some information and they are hoping, well, maybe if we don't say anything, it'll go away. They need to get out in front of it because eventually we'll catch up. We have.
I heard this from a citizen.
There's no
secrets.
There's no secrets.
I'm like, now what?
Yeah, it's and, you know. If I, you know, was to advise them on, you know, crisis management and everything like that, it's the step one is get the message out and be in control of that message. And, you know, it doesn't look good when something you should have disclosed to the public is first reported by, you know, a news organization. And so that's a big role for us. And we hope it sends a message to, you know, elected leaders. We also hope it sends a message to our audience and the greater community that we are asking the tough questions for you. So if you haven't read the Community Impact Report, check it out. It's online at cincinnati.com. It's just a quick snapshot of some of the stories that made a difference and many contributions from our staff. But of course, it wouldn't be an impact report without Sherry Coolidge's byline in there somewhere. So
thanks, Pearl.
So there you go. Well, is it time to talk to Mr. Fulcher?
Absolutely.
All right, let's do that. All right, it is special guest time on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. And we are so excited because we have David Fulcher with us. I'm going to give the quick intro. Three-time Pro Bowler with the Bengals, 86-92, played on the Super Bowl team, ended up with 31 picks, and of course, has the nickname Faux Rock, which we're going to get into a little bit here as well. David, how are you? And welcome to the podcast.
I'm doing great, my friend. How are you guys?
We're doing great. And full disclosure,
I'm counting down to the playoff game.
There you go.
Full disclosure, I've been wanting to get you on the podcast since we met a couple years ago, both working with the American Cancer Society's Real Men Wear Pink campaign. So I was thrilled to have the opportunity to meet and work with you on that. You're known for your philanthropy, but let's start. You were at Monday night's game. You were part of the opening festivities. That was one of the most electric stadiums I've been in a while. And then we had the Hamlin situation. Where were you when that happened, and what were you feeling as a former player?
Well, I actually am the uniform compliance officer for the NFL that works with the Bengals and the visiting team. My job is to make sure that each player is wearing the proper uniforms, from cleats to uniform to socks, anything that they have on their wrist. So I actually walk around the sideline, take care of that, and then I go up in the press box when the game starts. Obviously, because of the festivities of the Rule of the Jungle, I didn't get a chance to do that on the field. So I went straight from the Rule of the Jungle right to my seat in the press box. And from my seat and from my view, all I saw was a hit that everybody else saw. And then the young man fall to the ground. And then being up in the press box, I am there with the uniform compliance officers and the NFL and the league, and they are all making gestures and, oh, wow, and oh, my gosh, and didn't know what that was until I could see it on the monitor next to me where the young man had collapsed on the field from the hit, and we had no idea what was going on from there.
Were you thinking, you know, you yourself, we mentioned earlier, your nickname is Faux Rock. Garnered when you were in college, there was a tackle and the person that you hit went down, he gets back up and he was like, I feel like I was hit by a rock. I love that story. And I kind of went to look for it after I saw your Twitter handle, which is at Faux Rock. And were you thinking that it was just a hit when you were, because you're looking at it with all the experience that, you know, Burl and I were there that we did not have.
Well, yeah, I will tell you this. I when I saw the replay and I saw the replay over, normally the safety, which that's the position that I played, is the one who delivers the blow. Well, he actually caught the blow. And it just happened to be in a place where, you know, the heart was at its lowest peak of oxygen. And he got up because the natural instinct says get up. But when he went down, it was because he was at the lowest part of the breathing rate, according to the doctors, and it became a cardiac arrest. I thought it was just another football hit that I've done or have received over the years that I've played, and nothing outside of get the wind knocked out of you, get up, and the play goes on for the next play. But as we saw it, it did not happen. And once again, that where I got my nickname was exactly kind of similar. I hit a guy that knocked him out, laid on the ground for X amount of minutes, came to and said, I felt like I ran into a rock. And that's where I got my nickname. And once again, that guy got up, he went off the field, and we kept playing football. So this one was a little bit different.
When did you think to yourself, this is not normal?
When I saw the replay and the aftermath of what was going on, because the officials upstairs, they've got a live camera right on the sideline, right on the field. So when they started giving CPR and then came out and shocked him, then I knew there was something wrong, because football, that doesn't happen in football. We've never seen that. And I think for the players who were standing on the sideline, I had the same gut feeling that they had, that, oh my gosh, is this guy gone? What are they doing? Why are they resuscitating him? Why are they doing what they're doing? And I could feel the panic from the sideline to up in the press box, being with those officials watching that play.
Now, when situations like this happen, undoubtedly, it rekindles the discussion about the violent nature of the sport. Zach Taylor, during his first press conference, stated that, you know, this is the risk that professional football players understand, assume. He talked about how rare that situation was, but that everybody knows they have a job to do, and their job to do is to prepare for Baltimore. Can you reflect on your own experience? You know, you were known for hard hits. You were a safety that people feared. I think within two NFL seasons, that's what you were known for, you know, after being drafted out of ASU. Reflect on that a little bit, that aspect of the sport.
Well, you know, it is a, and we know it's a violent sport. Not too many people can run into a wall and get back up, because that's basically what you're doing. You run into another man, helmet to helmet, shoulder pad to shoulder pad, and you get knocked down and you get back up. So, yeah, we know the risk of what takes place when you play football, but, you know, a lot of us know that there's a possibility that you can, you know, break an arm, break a leg, you blow a knee out, break a finger, you know, get a concussion. But no one knows that there's going to be an ambulance that comes to the field and try to bring a guy back from the dead, in this case, bring him back to life. So we do know it's a job, and we know it's physical, and we have to go out there and play because we love playing the sport. That is our job. Our job is to hit. Our job is to tackle. Our job is to catch balls. Our job is to block people. And in that instinct, something could happen. But based off of what we saw Monday night at Buffalo and Cincinnati, that was something that was uncharted territory, because that doesn't happen. When the ambulance came out on the field, I knew that, you know, from there, that this could be a serious or major incident or some kind of major cause, because we don't see that. And obviously all the stuff that was happening throughout that that hurtness, or the guy getting hurt, when they put that blue tarp over him, trying to keep people from seeing it, I knew that there was something wrong.
So, do you think anything will change? You're saying we didn't know that this, you know, like this kind of risk, right? That's not just one, it's an unexpected one. Do you think anything will change because of this?
I don't know if the sport will change, because I don't know how you're going to stop people from hitting. The only way you stop that is you cancel football, and it's a big billion-dollar business, so that's not going to happen. But I do think that the awareness of what took place with the CPR and having all the machines on there, I think more of that is going to be in stadiums daily now. There's going to be more hospital security on the field, on the sideline. I think the NFL now sees exactly that. This was a freak accident. Don't get me wrong. Will it happen again? It may not happen again. It just happened to happen to this young man who took a shoulder into the sternum or in the chest area that caught him. You know, it's like somebody diving in the water and they blow all the air out of their body. They jump into the water and they try to inhale, and they can't inhale because there's no air left in the body to do that. So that's exactly what happened. So the only change that I could see is the NFL being more equipped on the sideline with those particular instruments or anything that, that the NFL or player needs on the sideline. But football is physical, and that will never change.
I have another question about kind of what you were thinking that night.
Yes.
As you were in the stadium, a lot has been said about the idea of resuming the game, like whose decision was it? And that's kind of being, you know, really examined by the media right now. But I think that you had to be in that stadium to understand what it felt like, and you were there. And so do you think that we should have resumed that game? There was such importance, like, after that, that decision, there was importance in that moment for human life. And then there's the business of football importance. Do you think we should have resumed that game?
I probably say no, because it was too traumatic for guys to see that and then ask them to come out and perform with that on their mind and thinking about, okay, if I hit somebody, is it going to happen to me? If I'm a receiver, am I afraid to come across the middle? So when you saw that, it was probably the best decision to make, because, you know, it's just football. It's not just this kid's life. It's just football, but it's more important for this young man's life than it is just the game of football. So let's make sure this kid is okay before we can resume to do what we need to do. And yes, there's a consequence behind it, and that is that both of these teams only played 16 games and not 17. And yes, there's going to be an issue when, if these teams continue to keep playing in the playoffs, whether they play that game that's going to come up. Is it in Buffalo? Is it in Cincinnati? Is it a neutral site? So it is a very, it is important that we, as fellow football players, respect the job. People respect the job. And we have a job to go out and play, but I don't think that that game could have been played with the mindset of every player playing that game, knowing that their fellow teammate and their alumni, their comrade went down. And I don't think I think they did the best job that they could do.
So let's look ahead. They had to mentally prepare for what ended up being a more important game against the Ravens than they thought, in terms of having a home field playoff game. They played a Baltimore team that had many starters injured, didn't handle the second half as well, but eked out the win anyway. What do you think this team needs to focus on to have a deep playoff run and maybe get back to the Super Bowl?
Well, you know, I tell people that we're dealing with a bunch of young guys that don't know nothing. And when I say know nothing, they're too young to understand the severity of, you know, what this franchise has been through over the years. A lot of these guys are coming from winning college organizations. So they know how to win. They know how to prepare. And I think they're just happy to be where they are. And like I said, they're so young that they don't know the severity of what has taken place under the Cincinnati Bengals regime over the years of not having winning seasons. They've heard about it, but these guys have never really experienced the losing part of it. So I think this football team is up for the challenge. They've been up for the challenge since they've got here. Joe Burrow's a winner. Ja'Marr Chase is a winner. Tyler Boyd's a winner. These guys have played on winning organizations, and Mixon, I heard him have a comment about, finally, we don't have to worry about anything bad happening because we control it and we're playing good football. So I think this football team just got to play like they know they've been playing. I know that sometimes they look good in the first half and they don't look good in the second half offensively, but they've got the mechanics and the athletes to overcome those things, and I think they're going to play some good football in this third match against Baltimore coming up in this playoff game.
So for you, having been to the Super Bowl, did not win. There's, you know, Joe Montana crushed the dreams of everybody in the greater Cincinnati area, but probably no more than anyone who was on that squad. Do you consider this unfinished business, as far as, you know, you are a Bengal, you've stayed in Cincinnati, you've been heavily involved with the team. Do you have a personal stake in the Bengals winning the Super Bowl, this particular team?
I don't know if I have a personal stake. I think for me, as a former player for Cincinnati, I would love to see the city of Cincinnati get a championship because I think they deserve it. I think our fans have been nothing but spectacular. And we saw that with the Hamlin injury, how the city of Cincinnati put up blue lights. You don't do that for another team. You don't do that for another city. And we did that. So my personal perspective on this is go out and win a Super Bowl for the city of Cincinnati. Yes, for the former players that played in the game. But, you know, personally, for those guys, you know, they got to go out there and play the game because they love playing it. And I think it's important that people understand why they do what they do. But I think it's it would be an honor to have a championship come to the city of Cincinnati. You know, because I think sometimes people look at, oh, well, you guys been to three Super Bowls, but you didn't win one. Those Pittsburgh Steelers fans always got to say something about how many rings they got. Well, you know what, Cincinnati, I think it's your time to have one. And it would be great for them to do it now instead of later. Because once you've been there, you know, Paul Brown said to me a long time ago when he was alive and I played, act like you've been there before. And I think this football team has act like they've been there because they are fighting hard to get back. And you could see how hard it is to repeat because of what the Rams are going through right now and what they've been through this last season. You stay healthy. You continue to do what you do. And then good things will happen. So far for us, some of the injuries haven't been critical, especially to our key players. As long as those key players stay where they are and continue to keep doing what they're doing, there's a chance for us to bring a championship back here. But as these young players see it, and I see it the same way, it's one game at a time. The Super Bowl does not exist. The Baltimore Ravens exist, and you got to take care of them first.
I think I read earlier this week that there is a pathway to have a possible rematch of the 88 Super Bowl between the Bengals and the 49ers. Is that?
That would be remarkable. It would be, because I thought last year when the Bengals were gotten in the playoffs that the 49ers would be the team that they would play in the Super Bowl. And obviously the Rams beat them, the 49ers, in the playoff game. But let me tell you something. I would love to see a San Francisco-Cincinnati Super Bowl. But in order for that to happen, we got to take care of Baltimore first. You don't look ahead. And that's what I like about this young team. You know, veteran guys, we kind of look down the road. These young guys are looking play-by-play, down-by-down, team-by-team. And the first team that's in their way to getting to the Super Bowl is the Baltimore Ravens.
Now, before we change, because we want to talk about some of the work you do teaching skills to people who are in prison, I did not know that you were the uniform compliance officer.
Neither did I. I'm dying to ask. Oh, my God. What happens when someone's not in compliance?
And well, can you tell us what you flagged and said, sorry, son, this is not going to fly. You need to get your proper uniform on.
Let me start by the beginning of telling you guys that what really happens is when I get to the game, I am watching the pregame warmups. Players will come out with a different shoe that they can't wear. They would come out with a shirt that it shouldn't be worn, or a visor on their face, on their helmets, that is too dark. Well, I get documents from the league of what a player can wear and what they can't wear. And I'm going to use the visors, for example. And I know sometimes it's really sunny out there, so a guy will wear a dark visor to tint the glare from hitting their eyes. Well, if you don't have a doctor's excuse, and I have that excuse, you can't wear it. So in pregame, I have to walk up. I'll use an example, Shamaje Perine. He always puts on a dark visor when he comes out to warm-ups. I write it up as a pregame violation. And then when I finish my violations, I then turn that information over to the representative for the Bengals, and he then goes into the locker room, and he goes and looks at all those players that I wrote down. They then correct those violations. When they come back out, I then go in-game violation. And then what I do is I then take the in-game violation and I go back and look at the pregame. And then I'm looking at every player, hoping that that player fixed their violation. If they fix their violation, I check it off. If they don't, I write it in an in-game violation. And then that guy now is going to be fined if he doesn't fix it before the game is over. Once that game is over with and that violation hasn't been corrected, I now send that information along to New York, to the people in New York, and then they look at it. Because in New York, they've got a probably a warehouse full of TVs, and they've got people looking at every game and every situation, and then they look at all the fines and violations. Then come Monday, when the checks are cut, that violation comes out of that check.
Do you think the players usually know they're in violation and hoping not to get caught? Or do you think it's oops, I didn't know?
Oh, no. Let me tell you. I've been doing this for almost 20 years.
That was going to be my next question. Were you the compliance guy when Chad Johnson was on the team?
Yeah, I was getting to that. So when Chad Johnson was playing, Chad used to do so many things that he kept me busy on Sunday. He kept everybody busy. And Chad would put money aside to pay his fine because he was going to do what he wanted to do. And when you're making that kind of money, you know, what's $10,000 to them? What's $50,000 to them? Which is kind of stupid. But, you know, once again, we're talking about somebody who's making millions of dollars, that what's a little bit of a fine to them. So, yeah, Chad was probably one of my biggest, I won't say a crime, but he was one of my biggest persons that every time I come to the stadium, I knew I was going to put 85 on my piece of paper and it was going to be a violation at the end of the day.
What's the craziest thing he wore?
He was a repeat customer, is I think what you're...
Yeah, so one of my biggest customer was Chad. But Chad Chad had a couple of things. One of them was he had if you can remember, Chad had put on a Hall of Fame jacket. He had this gold jacket made up. He put it on, like, representing he's a Hall of Famer. But that cost him $75,000 just to put that jacket on. Then he put on some gold shoes, and that cost him $25,000. So, you know, just what Chad was doing was marketing himself for after football. And that's why Chad does so many things outside of football now, that when he was in there playing, he was setting himself up for after football. And as you can see, it cost him a lot of money to do it, but he is doing the things that he does because of his uncharacteristic stuff that he did for the NFL.
I do have to say, when Mixon pulled the quarter out and I was watching at home for this last game, I was like, oh, yes, please. And I don't have $10,000, but I'm like, that was worth $10,000.
Well, and Chad has already said he's going to pay for that.
Yeah, Chad said he's going to pay for it. So Joe knew exactly what he was doing, and that the league is probably going to fine him a whole lot of money for doing that because, one, not that he just flipped a coin, but what he just showed the NFL was your way of fixing this kind of stunk, and I'm going to rub it in your face. So you can just imagine what the league is going to fine him and what that dollar amount might be because he just kind of rubbed it in their face. And, you know, quiet as kept, I probably would have did the same thing, but back in the 80s, making the money that I was making, I'm not sure I would have gave up my game check for that.
So, David, as you speak to us, I believe you're sitting outside of the Butler County Jail.
Yes.
You have, even though you're a guy from L.A., after your playing career was over, you stayed in Cincinnati. You've been a fixture on the, I would say, the philanthropy scene. You have a organization you founded called MANA, Mentoring Against Negative Actions. And like I said, you're sitting outside of the jail. You've just finished up working with some people who are there. Tell us about that cause, that effort, and what inspired you to do this work.
Well, you know, what's ironic for me is that I was born and raised in South Central Los Angeles. I've been around, obviously, some of the violence and some of the things that take place in L.A. So I've always had this in my gut of doing right, trying to do good things in the community and getting people to change the way they think. And many years ago, we started the MANA program, which back then it wasn't the MANA program, but it was still what we were doing, had a different title. And, you know, my dad being with the law enforcement in Los Angeles kind of gave me an idea of some of the things that I wanted to do. I didn't want to be a police officer, but I wanted to help people who were going and get incarcerated that they don't go in there. So we started the MANA program, Mentoring Against Negative Actions. And what we try to do with that program, because I work with the men who are incarcerated, my wife Judy, who just came out, she works with the females in the jail. And all we do is try to talk about common sense stuff. You know, I grew up on common sense. No meant no. Today, how many times you can ask your parent for something and then they'll give in and let you do it? Well, that's not what life is about. So what we try to do in our program is give them another way of changing the way they think. Think before you react. Put your family first. Put their needs before your needs. If there's something out there that doesn't make sense, you walk away from it. You don't have to do these things because somebody else is doing it. And most of the people that we work with that were incarcerated didn't have that kind of stern upbringing that I had. You know, I wasn't afraid of the gang members in Los Angeles or the drugs in L.A. I was afraid of my dad. When he told me no, it meant no. I was in the house before the streetlights came on. You know, I try to explain that to some of the men and women who are incarcerated, that if you could go back a minute or two before the crime that you were accused of, what would you do differently? And all of them say the right thing. So then I say, okay, now that you know, here's what we're going to do. You're going to apply that when you get out. So when you feel like you need to go rob a bank or rob a store or do some drugs, step back and ask yourself, what's best for me? What's best for my kids? What's best for my wife? What's best for my family? And do something different. So the MANA program is, I call it my 12-step program. And my 12-step program is just common sense. You don't need a drug. You don't have to pay money. You just have to change the way you think. And if you're thinking differently, there's a possibility that the choices that you make might be, the outcome could be different.
How can people like donate? Or is this the volunteer donate? I do want to say MANA, M-A-N-A, Mentoring Against Negative Actions. So that's the name of it. And how can people get involved?
Well, we just finalized our website, FulchersForLife.com. And what that FulchersForLife.com states, it states everything that I'm and my wife and I are part of, whether it's our MANA program, our MS program. We have a foundation that we help those who are affected by multiple sclerosis. My wife, Judy, was diagnosed with that over 25 years ago. Speaking engagements that people can request that I come and speak. And then we have a store of things that bingo related, my autograph, football pictures. My wife does a lot of female bling earrings and necklaces that people can purchase from there. And we do a lot, like I said, we do a lot in the community. So if anybody wants to talk about the MANA program, there's a tab on there that talks about it. You want to talk about the MS, there's a tab there. You want to talk about me, special appearances, there's a tab there. And then there's also a tab of the merchandise that we have, jerseys, footballs, mini helmets, earrings, jewelry that my wife has done. And all of that stuff that we do is because we were been blessed to go back and give back to our community. So it is there. FulchersForLife.com will get anybody. And you can do a Q&A. You can have questions of something that you want me to talk about or someplace I can go and visit. It's on the website. So, yeah, you can definitely do that. Donating, anything, leave a message. How can I do something? What can I do? Where will you be next? It's all on there.
David, thank you. Before we let you go, I want to go into the 2-minute warning. I've got just a couple remaining kind of real quick questions for you that I think our listeners might be interested in. So your rookie season was in 1986. Who was the biggest influence on you as a new Bengal in terms of mentoring or teaching you the ways of the NFL?
Wow. That's a pretty good question there, man. So when I came into the league as a rookie, and there were a bunch of guys on that team that that I looked up to and talked to. Lewis Breeden, that was his last year. Played with Lewis. Lewis played a couple of years, a bunch of years here in Cincinnati. Bobby Kemp. Bobby Kemp was a strong safety that I took his position when I came in. Bobby was a very small defensive back, but he hit like a big guy, and he was always, you know, hurting himself. My secondary, the secondary I played with, Lewis Billups, Solomon Wilcox, Eric Thomas, Barney Bussey, Ray Horton, those guys on that defense, Reggie Williams, former governor of Cincinnati. I think he was the governor of Cincinnati, but when I played with Reggie, Reggie was on our team. And there were a lot of guys. Boomer Esiason on the other side of the ball, Anthony Munoz. Those guys were very, very influential. And, you know, Sam Weiss. Sam Weiss, our head coach at that time. Dick LeBeau was my defensive coordinator. Those guys gave me an opportunity. And obviously the Browns family, Paul Brown, Mike Brown, those guys drafted me and giving me a chance to showcase my talent. So, you know, it was a bunch of guys that I hung around that they gave me the courage to play in the NFL and be the man that I was at that time. And as it went on, those were a lot of things that that took place in my life that gave me the opportunity to do what I needed to do.
I love that you could just rattle them off like that.
You know, it's funny because, you know, some people say, how do you remember all those people? How do you remember plays? You know, my wife and I, we talk about that, how when somebody say, hey, do you remember what happened on the football field against the Vikings in 1999 or 1983? Well, you know, I can remember some of those plays, but when you start talking about a specific play, yeah, I remember that. How do I remember the sack that I had against Montana in the Super Bowl? Oh, yeah, I remember that. I could see it right now that Joe ducked, and I kind of grazed him with my face mask in my hand. But, you know, that was something that you never forget.
I was going to ask you that. What is your biggest memory or your favorite memory of that Super Bowl game? Was it the sack against Montana?
Yeah, I think so. It was that, and then I hit Roger Craig and made him fumble. But I think the Roger Craig one was probably more than anything because when the game started, we were all out on the field, and I saw Roger Craig, and I put my hand out to shake his hand. And he just looked at me like I wasn't there. So then when I hit him and he fumbled, I made a gesture to him and said, if you just shook my hand, you probably wouldn't have never fumbled that football. So that was my, I think that might have been the biggest one out of them all. But to sack a legendary quarterback like Joe Montana was awesome.
I remember that, too. I remember that, too. Who is the greatest Bengal of all time?
Oh, wow. I would probably say Anthony Munoz. I think what Anthony represents spiritually and the work that he's done in the community, I think he's probably the greatest Bengal of all time. But, you know, there's a lot of great Bengal players, but that guy right there represents the Cincinnati Bengals probably better than anybody.
And my last question might be tough for you to answer because you're a humble guy, but should David Fulcher be in the Ring of Honor?
I believe so. I don't know when. I would like to see it in my lifetime, which I think I will, as long as I stay healthy. But there's a lot of older gentlemen whose names are on that list that paved the way for me to be where I am today. So let's take care of the old guys, get them where they need to be. And when my name is called, I'll be happy to see that.
All right. Well, David, we can't thank you enough for chatting with us. We could go on and on and on, but you're a busy guy. So we're going to let you go. And Sherry, you good with this?
I am. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation this morning.
I appreciate you guys getting me out there, man. And anytime you need me, I'm available. Just give me a shout.
I'll talk to you before the Super Bowl.
There you go. There you go. Y'all take care.
All right, David. Bye. Thank you.
See you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I feel like I'm walking away with that interview. It was super fun, but I learned a lot too. And he really had great insights on the game. So I appreciate him sharing those with us. And I love a good Chad Johnson reference. Now, come on. Like, who doesn't remember all of that?
Well, and maybe this was common knowledge, but I had no idea he was the compliance guy four games at Paul Brown's, or sorry, Paycor Stadium. And those Chad Johnson stories are hilarious. I mean, that was worth the interview right there. But I'm going to just put it out there. He should be in the Ring of Honor sooner than later.
Agree. Third, we don't have a vote, but we have a
vote. We don't have a vote. I mean, three-time Pro Bowler. He's like, I think he's number three on the list of interceptions as a Bengal. I think he'll be on there sooner than he thinks. But we're at that time, Sherry, where we talk about the Vasto Cincinnati moment of the week. And you were teasing me earlier that you had something.
I have to say, so Phil and I missed you at the Inquirer happy hour.
All right. Can I, before you go on, this is an ongoing thing with Maddie Mitchell, our education reporter, who's also the cruise director of the Inquirer social team. She does not consult me when she puts these happy hour dates on a calendar. She
That's
always
weird.
Picks
she
like,
consults me.
Well, she should. She has her
intriguing.
But it's like you can just guarantee that if she throws a date on the calendar for happy hour, that's like the one evening that week that I have a conflict. So that's not true. I've been to a couple of them, but I'm sure my absence was not even noticed.
Oh, it was. And I'm going to tell you why. So here we go.
Oh, geez.
First of all, I want to say that it was in Walnut Hills. We went to Esoteric Brewery. That neighborhood, you know, we're fresh off Joe Biden visiting that neighborhood as a surprise with Mayor Puravall. And so it was interesting to look at all of the building that's going on there. So we kind of picked different places that so we can all meet up and everything. And so we were in Walnut Hills. And it happened to be, right, Phil, 2000s trivia night. And so...
No way.
At the last... I'm not a big trivia person, but at the last second, I was like, you guys, Bobby Nightingale is there. I'm like, we got sports. Rasputin was there. He's entertainment. I was like, you guys, we got this. So, Victoria...
I'm jealous already. I have
Victoria
so much-
Morwood, she's on our News of Now, like a lot of like the news that's kind of breaking at the moment in the mornings. She took the initiative, and we're doing this at the last second. You have to download an app. Our name as a group was Newspaper Slingers. She did come up with that on the fly. I kind of loved it. And we did terrible.
What? Oh,
we
no.
We feel like we needed you.
Are you kidding me? Because right. Back in the day, back in the long time Inquirer readers will remember, in the early 2000s, we had Sin Weekly, which was an Inquirer publication targeting younger readers, which I was at the time. And we had a trivia. We didn't have I shouldn't say we had a trivia team, but we would go play trivia, the Sin Weekly crew, and we would dominate, just dominate, crush the competition, including one night City Beat had a team. And so that was our arch rivalry at the time. We mopped up a floor with them. I mean, we were unstoppable. So I'm a little disappointed that to hear this news today.
So one of the questions, and we felt you would know this because you were at USA Today. Phil, what okay. was like one of the years that where was the Olympics? Phil, what year was it?
I can't remember that one.
2004.
It was the Athens Olympics.
Athens.
And none of us knew. And we were like, would Burl know that if he was here? Or we felt
not
like
not only
he
that,
would.
I have the T-shirt. Like my cousin sent me the T-shirt. I mean, guys. Okay, well.
I know. When we came in, like, fourth or fifth?
Oh, you're killing me.
We're going to be more prepared. And, you know, good luck to trivia people at the brewery. Because, you know, if we come back, we know better and we'll be better prepared.
That's it. I'm going to run you guys through some trivia training.
Oh, my God. There's like eight of us. Keith Pandolfi. We did terrible.
What? Oh my gosh. All
there
right,
was more
well,
people you could, eight was the maximum you can have on the team. We had a huge turnout from the Inquirer, but we, you know, stuck to the rules. We didn't cheat and look on our phones and like, it was fun.
Let me ask you this. Did the team that won, were they just a group of friends or were they from another like company, group, team. You know what I mean?
You know what? That brewery is actually gigantic, and I didn't get a good handle on who the actual winner was. I was more focused on losing, Burl. I don't know if you know me, but I'm super type A.
But, like, well, I guess what I'm getting at, you didn't lose to, like, a team from WCPO.
Definitely not. This was loose at best.
All right. That's
which is even more embarrassing. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Well, that's a good story. That's, you know, playing trivia on a Tuesday night in Cincinnati. That's a good Cincinnati moment, Sherry. Yeah,
but Esoteric is a great addition to Walnut Hills. And it's been there a couple of years now. They had this amazing, like, chicken place that had a window into. Everybody was eating. So it was a good night.
No, that's good. Well, maybe listeners to the That's So Cincinnati podcast will get some good trivia from this interview with Fulcher,
I have one more quick thing. We are going really long. I know. It's so hard, you guys. So hard to stop talking. All right. I have a special request. I'm going to ask this every week if Burl lets me. Okay? Like, this is crazy. I know.
Let me just say right now that Sherry has not discussed this with me prior to recording. So I'm hearing it for the first time. She's put me on the spot, but go ahead.
It's time for the Cincinnati City Beat Best of Cincinnati. Last year, That's So Cincinnati came in second to the Cincinnati Zoo's podcast, and, like, our feelings aren't even hurt. The zoo is the zoo.
However, no, Thane Maynard's a rock star. You can't, you know.
I agree, but I want this for Phil. I love this podcast. It takes, like, extra time during the week. It's so much fun. I get to talk to amazing people. But if you guys are, you know, listeners and you love us, thank you for spending your time with us. First of all, I know there's a lot of choices for podcasts. That's for sure. You can go to the Cincinnati City Beat website. You can vote once a day. Hint, hint. And if you could vote for us, that would be amazing.
I endorse that, Sherry. I think that's a great idea.
Well, I wrote down what category it was under. I feel like it's under City Life to help you along. But there's a lot of good categories. And Keith Pandolfi and myself are up for Best Reporter. But if you could vote for Keith there, that would be great, because I definitely don't do my reporting for awards. Okay, I do that. Everything I do as a reporter, I say to myself, what does the community need to know? And that's the only thing I care about. And they want to know and need to know. That's really what's happening there for that. But I love this podcast, you guys. Thanks.
All right. Well, there you go. Vote early, vote often.
Exactly.
And you know what? If there was a City Beat Award for the longest podcast,
we'd win.
The podcast that goes over the time target set by the editor, we would win hands down. So be that as it may, yes, vote early, vote often, and let's call it a podcast, Sherry.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, everyone.